The final case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Casey Onken. For the appellant, Mr. Onken, is Mr. Brian Anderson, who is an attorney from Rapid City. And for the State of South Dakota is Mr. Frank Geegan, an assistant attorney general from Pierce. Mr. Anderson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Counsel. Your Honor, this case started in June of 06, as far as being charged out, where Mr. Onken was charged with five identical counts of pedophilia, criminal pedophilia, and in the alternative, with five counts, all identical of sexual contact. He was convicted of only one sexual contact. So that really left a void, both for the state and myself, as far as a resolution of the case. So he appeals that one conviction for sexual contact. The facts of these cases started 2 years earlier, or further back to 1996, when Casey Onken and Heather Thomas were dating. J.O. was born in August of 97, and A.O., their son, was born in May of 1999. Their relationship was on again, off again, and at some point, it was broken off with several protection orders put out. Mr. Onken was not allowed to see his children. At some point, however, the HT relented and allowed him visits in August of 04. And that went on until December of 03. There was testimony that these were regular visits every other weekend. There was also testimony that it was impromptu, brought over at any time, and not as regulated as HT testified to. In any event, it stopped in December of 03 abruptly. The testimony was that there was a fight. The mother was called, came, got the children, and never brought them back. And I believe another protection order was put out. In November of 05, J.O. disclosed to her mother, with the help of her brother, A.O., that Casey had raped her. She was forensically interviewed by Laura Hawkins. This was not her first time being forensically interviewed. She had been interviewed before in regards to some allegations she made that the children at a daycare were humping her, was her words. And immediately when she began this interview with Laura Hawkins, she told her it's happening again. This humping is happening again to her. But what she describes to Laura Hawkins is this: Casey would leave the kids alone, he would go to the bar, he'd get really drunk, he'd come home, rip her clothes off, and simply ravish her, was the description. Now, she said this happened about five times, and that's where we get the five charges. At trial, she would say that it happened every weekend or every other weekend. Also in this interview, she said she confided to her friend, Bibi, at a daycare, that this had happened to her, and that VB may have told her brother AO what to tell the mother if she JO wasn't able to tell her mother.
Now, is that a video that you were able to observe, or how was that preserved for you to see, if at all?
It was preserved by way of the forensic interview video. Both forensic interview videos of her allegations at the daycare previously and her allegations about Casey Onken were put into the record.
And you did receive those as part of the discovery, correct?
That's correct.
So I guess the point is, if you received Hawkins' interview, you knew about the VB allegation at the point in time that you first reviewed the Hawkins forensic interview.
That's correct. Justice.
So you knew how important or unimportant that would be in the trial.
That's correct. We were appointed in April. Our office was appointed in April 30th. The following hearing was held on May 21st, and it was that time that I filed our standard office motions in cases like this that include a motion to release records held by the Department of Social Services that is routinely granted. And on that, I included the initials VB, but specified in that motion that I didn't know yet who her parents were or who her guardian was and who her date of birth or anything about her. I specified in there that it was unknown. Included in that motion, or along with that motion, was our standard motion to require prosecution to make inquiries and provide notice regarding allegations or reports, that is, reports to law enforcement or reports to any person or any agency. And I also filed a motion for a bill of particulars to specify exactly what dates, if at all possible, because we had five identical counts. Those are our normal standard motions. I thought that it was put on the record at that time, and that's what I said at trial, that we had spoke about VB. We may have very well spoke about VB on that date, but it was off the record clearly. Part of that is why I'm using the initials VB now. We don't want those names put out in court. In court, there were reporters, several members of both families, and several deputies to keep these families apart. So I can tell you the discussions were had, but not on the record. And the reasons for that is to keep that name out of the public as much as possible. I would point out that continuing on the different status hearing, the following on June 25th, we noted for the court we're still waiting for the records. The next one, July 30th, I made a specific record that we needed new DSS records because we'd received the records. It pointed to a second family that may have had there was a family with children that acted inappropriately with J.O., so we asked that those records be received, and we did receive those records. And I noted to the court we still need a report on the prior acts motion, and we still need a bill of particulars. August 13th, we were still waiting for both the bill of particulars and the report on the prior acts. And then September 4th is when the state filed the bill of particulars setting out that the acts occurred every other weekend between August, the dates listed in the indictment, a total of 8 possible dates or weekends. It was at that time, I would submit, and no record was made on September 4th because Judge Delaney was covering Judge Kern's calendar, and so we didn't need a hearing, and so myself and the prosecutor reset that September 4th hearing for my evidentiary hearing that was held in October on the prior bad acts 404B motion that I filed as a result of his report fulfilling that motion. But again, no record of that was made, but I submit that you can see my due diligence and I'm not acting in bad faith as I keep trying to get the state moving forward to get those required reports in. So then at the time of the...
Let me just ask, when did you know that this VB was an actual person? When did that become apparent to the state and to yourself?
Upon my cross-examination of J.O. at the time of trial.
Okay, so all the prior discussions with the state, it was never apparent to either the state or yourself or just yourself that this was an imaginary person.
On the August 13th hearing, the state indicates that they cannot get a hold of the mother and they've been trying to contact her. So at that point, he had no knowledge of who VB was at that time. It was sometime after that that he was told by the family that they didn't know who VB was.
How did it harm or prejudice your case that you did not know of the existence of VB until you learned about it at trial?
J.O. has accused, or did accuse Casey Onken of raping her. There's no medical evidence. There's there is a witness, A.O., but no physical evidence, no DNA, no hair samples, no medical damage, just her statements. Our defense then, or any defense in a case like that, is to get up and say, no, I didn't. The only other defense tactic is to poke holes in the small girl's testimony or show her as being untruthful.
How old was the child, the complaining witness?
She was 9, almost 10 at the time of trial.
And would have been how old at the time?
7 at the time of the alleged act.
Can you identify specifically then how the VV testimony, this third party, would have assisted you in poking holes in the complaining witnesses or showing her as untruthful?
Yes. In the video and in her testimony, she describes vaginal penetration, ejaculation, sticky yellow stuff. If our position is that didn't happen to her as a result of Casey's action, so we need to find some other source of where she would learn that. How would she learn that a male ejaculates and that the stuff is yellow and sticky? And we get that from other sources. And that's why we get the DSS records to see if there's been prior accusations or if she's committed some behavior that she would have gained knowledge of that. If, in fact, VB had been molested or had been exposed to this, and then was able to impute that knowledge to J.O.
What do you know about VB? What did you finally learn?
Well, we finally learned that the name used in the videotape was short for her actual name, and when we had her actual name, was the difference between Bill and William, we were able to determine that our office indeed represented the parents in an A&N action. So we actually had the DSS records in our possession.
And did those DSS records indicate that that child, the VB child, had experiences similar to the same descriptions that the complaining witness here had?
No, they did not. They were very brief. The mother in that case had left her in the care of a young man, and this that was not related to her, and this concerned the Department of Social Services, and that's why they stepped in.
Okay, so nothing in the record indicated the full extent of it.
No, just that there was.
So you would have needed to pursue that further.
Absolutely.
Was there any testimony by the younger brother, who was 4 at the time, A.O.?
He did testify that he observed Casey rape J.O. and that he was having sex with her, was his testimony. And the court noted that those are terms that a 4-year-old doesn't normally, shouldn't normally know.
Didn't he also indicate that he woke up because the bed was creaking and that he tried to push him off? He tried to push a client off?
Yes, that's correct. This was described by both AO and JO as Casey just simply coming in the room and performing this act and then leaving.
Was the younger brother also exposed to VB?
He indicated at trial that he had not spoken to her. It was JO's videotape that reveals where she told the interviewer that. She told VB that she was reluctant to tell her mother, and so VB suggested that AO tell their mother, and if AO, and it's disputed at this point, that if AO needed help, that VB would talk to AO and help him.
So your version of it is that the possibility that VB could have coached both of those young children, the younger brother and the complaining witness?
Yes, coached or imputed the knowledge of the acts that she describes.
At some point in the record, does it indicate what VB would have said or did say? Or you don't know?
We don't know yet at this
okay.
point. It was my motion to have a continuance to have her interviewed either professionally or by someone other than myself that may investigator, a mandatory reporter or something, because I didn't want her to be the first person she discloses it an act to and become
a
witness.
You would have actually been placed in a conflict of interest situation, wouldn't you have?
Absolutely. I don't know what she was going to say if she was going to implicate my client or another client of the office or even a third person, then the defense attorney becomes a state's witness.
To go back to that influencing the sister, the complaining witness and her younger brother, she didn't talk to A.O., but she may have influenced him theoretically through the sister, right?
That's correct, Justice.
And, of course, she wouldn't have been able to supply the information that A.O. came up with that he tried to, that when he awoke, that he tried to push or kick your client off of his sister.
No.
I mean, that would have had to come somewhere independently from him, even though he's only 4 years old.
Yes, he's got quite a description of being his, the testimony was that he helped his sister and he fought Casey and they both ran together to the neighbors. He's really being his sister's keeper from the testimony.
And in fact, he was the one who told the mother that, J.O. was raped or seduced by Mr. Unken.
Correct. What he said was that Casey had sex with J.O.
He spelled out the word.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Like I said, my request, the issue I captioned in the appeal was that did the court err in not granting a mistrial or a continuance, but clearly the record shows that I asked for a continuance and did not receive a continuance from the court. And the test there that the court has said is whether the delay resulting from the continuance would prejudice the opposing party. Well, the state had rested at that point, so they had gotten all their testimony that they were to present in, so I don't believe the state would have been prejudiced by a continuance to have her interviewed. And secondly, was a continuance motivated by procrastination, bad timing, dilatory tactics, or bad faith? And again, I spelled out that I had been asking for the reports and the bill of particulars and constantly as we moved along once our office was appointed. And thirdly, the prejudice caused to the moving party. The prejudice to us, I spelled out, is that we did not have that opportunity to see if there was a different source of her knowledge of the state of the acts that she described to both the forensic interviewer and at the trial.
Well, the charge then that he's actually convicted of doesn't match her description. Is that right?
That's correct.
Doesn't match the younger child's description.
That's correct.
Neither one? Or does it match the boy, the brother's? Could it fit within the brother's description of what transpired?
I don't believe so. The testimony from J.O. was clearly that there was penetration, and it was not slight. It was a ravishing that she described. However, I suppose the jury could see, recognize that a child's definition of a penetration could be that different from an adult and what she felt. Or
2 minutes, counsel.
And how many, and the charges were like five different incidents and then a lesser included? And, I mean, is that kind of how it was? It was an alternative?
It was five charges of criminal pedophilia and then the alternative with sexual contact. All the dates were the same date range.
All the dates were the same.
They were completely identical. It was the bill of particulars that was given that limited it to weekends, every other weekend during that time period.
Okay.
But there were still eight possible dates.
Okay, and they rejected that for one sexual contact.
Correct.
On what date, do we know?
It was the count two, so it would be the first weekend. She did give testimony that the first incident happened around her birthday, and that was the only concrete date, and that's the only reason I would submit that they chose that particular count.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Gagan, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. As you know, the only issue presented on appeal is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in denying the defendant's request for a continuance based on the state's alleged violation of discovery order. Before addressing the merits of that issue, the state would like to take just a minute to briefly discuss the facts leading up to and giving rise to the defendant's conviction for sexual contact with a child. The record reflects that the victim's mother, H.T., began dating the defendant in 1996. It was shortly thereafter, in August of 1997, that the victim, J.O., was born. A second child, the victim's brother, A.O., was later born in May of 1999. When their relationship ended in 2000, H.T. obtained a protection order against the defendant. That protection order subsequently expired in 2004, and H.T. indicated that she thought, well, it's been a long time. I'm a different person. Maybe the defendant is too. She therefore decided maybe I should give visitation a shot, so that's what she decided to do. Testimony was presented that the victim and a younger brother began having visitation with the defendant on the weekend of her seventh birthday, August of 2004. That visitation, however, ended only a few months later in December of that same year. H.T. testified that she knew that was when the visitation stopped because there was an incident when J.O. called me on the phone and she was hysterical. The victim told her mother that she was hiding in the bathroom from the defendant. H.T. immediately petitioned the court for another protection order, which was dated December 3 of 2004. Now, when H.T. picked up the victim that afternoon, she had no idea that she had been abused sexually by the defendant.
Is this the birthday weekend?
Yes.
That's the one he gets convicted of.
I'm not sure. I mean, that's when the visitation started, and it continued through December. And I think the indictment charged used the on or about language from August to December. The victim never said anything to her mother because she was simply too scared to tell her. The victim testified that the defendant threatened to hurt me. I didn't know what he meant. I didn't know what he would do. H.T. eventually found out what had happened on Thanksgiving Day 2005. She testified that she was taking her children to Chamberlain to spend the holiday with her family. As they were on their way there, her son told her that the victim had been sexually abused. According to H.T.
So how long a time in between? How many months then? Or was it longer than that?
The visitation would have stopped in December of 04, is when she petitioned for the second or more recent protection order. And then she ultimately was told what had happened in November of 05.
So almost a year later. And so the child at the time of the incident would have been how old?
I believe at the time of the abuse she would have been seven.
Seven.
Because the visitation started on the weekend of her seventh birthday, August of 2004.
So these would be memories that are a year old, from the four-year-old and from the seven-year-old.
Yes. According to H.T., my son said to me, I don't know where it came from, my son said, Casey, referring to the defendant, had sex with J.O. H.T. testified that when I looked into the mirror and I saw the look on her face, I just knew. She was my daughter. I just knew it was true. Just as soon as the words started coming out of her brother's mouth, big tears came out of the victim's eyes. According to the victim, the defendant would get on top of her and do what she referred to as icky things. Although the victim attempted to keep her legs together, the defendant would simply pull them apart. The victim testified that while the defendant was on top of her, his private parts would spray stuff out. Her testimony was corroborated at trial by that of her younger brother, A.O. A.O. testified that he was sleeping on a floor in the defendant's bedroom. He woke up, however, when he heard the bed moving, the bed creaking. He saw the defendant on top of his sister, and his body was said to be going up and down. AO tried to push the defendant off but was not able to do so. Although the victim tried to scream, she testified she was not able to because the defendant made it so I couldn't breathe. He covered my mouth. VB, the victim's friend from daycare, was the very first person that she had confided in and told what had happened. VB simply told the victim that if she was too scared to tell her mother, she should just tell her brother to tell her, since he was there and witnessed the abuse. That brings us then to the issue raised here on appeal.
Do we know how old VB is at this time? At the time that she has the he has the discussion.
I believe there's some testimony in the record that she may have been a couple years older than the victim, and I think there's some reference to the fact that she may have been a preteen. It should be noted at the outset that the defendant has failed to make absolutely any showing whatsoever that the state violated a discovery order issued by the court. It simply cannot be said that the trial court abused its discretion in denying the defendant's request for a continuance when the defendant has made no showing that a discovery violation ever occurred in this case. The state would submit that before the issue of sanctions become relevant under statute, SDCL 23A-13-17, the defendant must first make a threshold showing that a discovery order was in fact violated. Statute provides, and I quote, if at any time during the course of a proceeding it is brought to the attention of the court that a party has failed to comply with an applicable discovery provision, the court may order such party to permit their discovery or inspection, grant a continuance, or prohibit the party from introducing evidence not disclosed, or it may enter such other order as it deems just under the circumstances. The statute goes on to provide that the court may specify the time, place, and manner of making the discovery and inspection, and may prescribe such terms and conditions as it deems just.
Was the motion strictly related to failure to turn over the discovery, or was the motion made that we've just discovered this and that I need more time to pursue this?
It's difficult to answer. The record reflects that prior to trial, and I believe defense counsel commented on this morning, I believe it was in May, he had filed a motion with the court asking the court for an order directing the Department of Social Services to release any records they had pertaining not only to the victim and her family, but also to VB as well. Now, the order later signed and entered by the court in June referred only to the victim's family. There was no mention, no reference therein to VB. Now, although the defendant filed a second motion in August, again with the court, asking that the Department of Social Service be directed to release records, those records pertain to the victim's aunt and her children. There was no mention by the defendant in the second motion of VB. The only time we get reference to VB and any alleged violation of the discovery order is after the state had closed its case in chief. When the state had closed its case in chief, the defendant then informed the court that, wait a minute, we have this discovery issue pertaining to VB.
And that's when you turned over the records of the social services that you had at that time?
What had happened, there was some exchange, an attempt to determine by the trial court what motion the defense counsel was talking about in reference to VB. So the court specifically asked the defendant, where is the request for VB at? And in response to that question, the defendant maintained, it's on the record when we had the motion hearing, referring to the May 21st motion hearing. According to the defendant, it was on the record where we made mention of VB, we need to inquire about her, who she is, her parents. The defendant went further and alleged that we also made a record that it was the state's duty to inquire. Now, unfortunately for the defendant, the set of record doesn't support any of those insertions. As indicated in the state's brief, the state's attorney informed the court, I don't remember making a record on that, Your Honor. More importantly, neither did the trial court. The trial court indicated, trust me, I don't recall that either. The defendant was therefore asked if he had a transcript of the hearing he was referring to, where they could verify it. defendant indicated, however, that he had asked for one. So at that point, the trial court was concerned with how do we know it happened. So it indicated to the parties that it was going to try to pull something up to see how squarely that was addressed at all. And the court went on to state on the record that I'm not sure I see a discovery violation here. The court therefore informed the defendant that at the moment we're going to proceed with the trial. Now the record does reflect that the trial court later did have an opportunity to review a transcript of the motion hearing referred to by defense counsel. As indicated by the court, however, I can't find VB mentioned in there any place. The court therefore held that at this stage of the game, to whatever extent there was a motion for a continuance, even a mistrial, I'm going to deny those motions. Now, with all due respect to defense counsel, the state would submit that the trial court did not abuse its discretion when the record clearly shows that there was no discovery order for the state to have violated. Now, even if it could be said, for sake of argument, that the state failed to comply with the discovery request, the defendant still has not shown any abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court. Under statute, the remedy for non-disclosure is entrusted. It's left to the sound discretion of the trial court. This court has repeatedly said in the past the trial court has the inherent authority to fashion whatever remedy it deems appropriate under the circumstances. Here, the only remedy sought by the defendant was a continuance. When asked by the court what remedy he was looking for, the defendant replied, a continuance now that we know where BB is at. In deciding, however, whether to grant a continuance, the factors to be considered by the court include whether there's any delay, bad faith, or dilatory practice on the part of the moving party, what, if any, prejudice would result to the moving party if the request is denied, and whether or not there are any prior continuances or delay in the record. Here the record shows that there were numerous delays at the defendant's request in bringing this matter to trial. In July 2006, the defendant waived the 180-day rule and asked the court for a continuance indicating that he was in the investigative stage, conducting interviews and gathering witnesses. The court was later again asked for another continuance in February 2007 when the defendant indicated he was still in the process of drafting motions. The matter was set to go to trial in May of 2007. Unfortunately, the court had to reschedule when the defense counsel, in late April, filed a motion with the court asking for permission to withdraw. Now, more importantly, the state would submit that the defendant failed to exercise any due diligence in attempting to obtain any information pertaining to BB. The record reflects that the state, in November 2006, filed notice of its intent to offer the hearsay statements made by the victim when interviewed by Laura Hawkins. The state at that time provided the defendant with a videotape of that interview wherein reference was made to BB. It's clear, therefore, that the defendant was put on notice of her existence. In fact, when asked by the trial court where he came up with information pertaining to BB, the defendant replied from the Laura Hawkins video. It's clear that the defendant was therefore aware of BB's existence and during the course of the trial repeatedly questioned the state's witnesses. While cross-examining the victim, defense counsel attempted to suggest, now this person doesn't exist, does she? Defense counsel also questioned the victim, you don't know who this person would have been. Similar questions were posed to both the victim's mother and her brother.
Referring to VB.
And yet, for whatever reason, defense counsel elected to wait until after the state had rested before bringing it to the court's attention that there was a discovery issue pertaining to BB's identity.
Was there other evidence presented about coaching or suggestions of that or expert testimony indicating there wasn't any coaching?
There was testimony from Laura Hawkins, the forensic interviewer, who testified that she did not see any indications whatsoever when interviewing the victim that she had been coached. Ms. Hawkins testified that she was trained to look for what she referred to as source monitoring, trying to determine what prompted the child to come forward with the allegations. In her opinion, that being Ms. Hawkins, if the child had been coached, there would be clear indications of that in the record. And yet she saw none of that when she interviewed the victim. She simply referred to this, again, as a case of accident and a disclosure. As pointed out by defense counsel, it was actually the victim's brother who made the outcry on behalf of his sister.
Did Hawkins also interview the four-year-old or the brother, or just the victim?
I believe the videotape that I observed is only that of the victim. As far as the dilatory practices on the part of defense counsel, the state would like to point out that at the end or conclusion of the first day of the trial proceedings, the state agreed that it would obtain a phone number and address for BB and her family. The court at that time specifically instructed the defendant that he was to contact BB's family between now and dawn. Although the state's attorney provided the defense with a phone number where they could reach BB and her family, the defendant made no attempt to do so before the trial resumed the following morning. When asked by the court if he was able to contact BB last night, the defendant simply replied, "No, Your Honor, it was 5:30. I had no staff here. I wasn't going to make a phone call like that myself." When the trial court took a recess later that morning, in order to settle jury instructions, the court again inquired of the defendant and asked if his paralegal had interviewed BB yet. Once again, the defendant made no attempt to do so and simply told the court, "No, I just got this note." That note apparently was in reference to an A&N, an abuse and neglect file, the paralegal had provided to defense counsel. The court at that time told the parties, "Well, I will let counsel go in and look at them together right now. You've got 15 minutes. Go." Although the defendant seems to complain on appeal that he and the state were allowed only 15 minutes in which to review the file, the state would submit that the trial court acted well within its discretion. Statute specifically provides that the trial court may specify the time, place, and manner of inspection and may prescribe such terms and conditions as it deems adjusted. And here defense counsel admits in his reply brief, and admits again here today, that the A&N file in question was obtained from their own files. The defendant, therefore, had ready access to it. He offered no explanation on the record as to why he could not have recovered that file sooner than what he had. And finally, there's no indication in the record that the defendant objected on the grounds that the time frame allowed by the court was inadequate.
2 minutes.
The state would submit that when a party fails to object and appears to have acquiesced in the court's rulings, he must be deemed to have accepted sin. And finally, the state would submit that the defendant has not shown any prejudicial error stemming from the trial court's refusal of his request for continuance. As indicated in the defendant's own brief, not every failure to provide evidence as ordered results in prejudicial error. This court has repeatedly said on a number of occasions, it is not error alone that reverses judgments of conviction, it is error plus injury. Here, defendant has simply not shown any prejudicial error. And with that, the state will close by asking the court to affirm defendant's conviction in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Geegan. Mr. Anderson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Just to clarify, J.O.'s birthday would have been August 14th, and it was that weekend of August 13th and 15th that count two referred to and that she was convicted of, or that J.O. and Casey Onken was convicted of. Also, we determined that BB would have been 13 at the time of trial, so in her discussions with, we don't know the time frame those discussions took place, but she would have been 12 or 11 at the time she had the discussions at the daycare with J.O. I went back and looked at what exactly the court instructed or what exactly the court said on after determining that we now had BB's address and instructed the state to get that information to me. And the court stated, "But if we have an address and an opportunity, perhaps defense can get a hold of her and do an interview and decide what they want to do, but they have to do that between now and dawn." It was more of a statement of fact rather than an order for me to go out and interview this child. But and like I told the court the next day, I couldn't go out by myself and become a and have a conflict of interest, then either in this case or another case. And as Laura Hawkins testified at trial, there's several steps that she goes through before interviewing a witness that she's learned from other court cases, where she's got to make sure and not ask leading questions. She's got to establish a rapport. She's got to set the whole interview up before just going into, okay, tell me what happened. And so I was not in a position to interview her that evening.
What about the fact, I mean, you have both the children, the brother and the alleged victim, both of them testified, correct?
That's correct.
And you had the opportunity to cross-examine them, because what you're really arguing here, you were prejudiced because of your lack of being able to challenge the credibility of the witnesses. So, but you were able to cross-examine them. What about that? Doesn't that give you enough opportunity to challenge the credibility or the validity of their stories?
I would say no, that if in fact VB had some knowledge and had spoke to her about what had happened, spoke to J.O. and told her what had happened to herself, and if that's mirroring what she told to
But you could have asked her that, yeah. Couldn't you? I mean, you knew about VB, that you'd listened to that tape. You could have asked her that.
I could have asked her, did VB tell you this? Yes, I didn't ask her that. Because from my, if you read the transcript, I tried to impeach her with, well, VB doesn't exist, because that's what I had been told, and she surprised me by saying, oh, yes, she does. And so at that point, I didn't have a line of questioning, I guess, to put forth. And as far as coaching, DeLaura Hawkins' opinion and so forth, that was not allowed to be presented to the jury. She was only allowed to testify to what I had just stated, that she's the format that she set up and that she did not ask leading questions and so forth, and then introduce a videotape. And the court decided that the videotape would speak for itself, and then Ms. Hawkins would not be allowed to vouch or to expand on or to give her opinion on that to the jury. And so I would just point out that our prejudice, or even if the court finds there was not a sufficient record to find a discovery violation, I would ask that the court still find that the trial court erred in not granting a continuance once we determined that VB did exist. Because of all the factors set out in the test, the interview could have been done rather quickly had we got it set up with the proper interviewer. And then the state had already gotten all its witnesses and all its testimony in at the time, so it would not be unduly burdensome on them. The only burden would have been on delaying the jury trial for maybe a day or an afternoon. So the defense was prejudiced in that fact, and based on that, I asked the court to set aside the verdict and set the matter for a new trial.
Did you, after the trial, the verdict came in, did you or anyone in your office try to contact this child and get an interview and then get maybe an affidavit or something so that you could use that in a motion for a new trial?
No. The verdict was very, like I said, surprising.
But now you have, I mean, the sentencing is, what, a few weeks after the verdict, so
right.
You've got time. You can go out and now and find this child, get the proper interview in, and then bring that to the court and say, now, Judge, you see what's happened here. You didn't give me a continuance. We did find this child. Look what she says. We want a new trial now, Your Honor. We'd like to have a new trial because this witness indicates something very important. But you never went out and looked for that child.
No, just and the reason is like I said, at the testimony at trial from the little girl, J.O., was that it happened every weekend or every other weekend. So it's potentially 16 separate acts of penetration is what she alleged, or 8. In any event, more than the 5. So I sat down with Mr. Onken and went over the verdict with him that he was just convicted of the one sexual contact, if we ask for a new trial, we're going to, or even still today, if you reverse this, we're still, the door is still open for him to be charged with an additional three or more counts of pedophilia. So we've made a record or recording with him and others in my office that he did not want to pursue appeal. So I did not go out and interview the girl so as to, because at the time I thought he was not going to seek an appeal. But eventually his family, after that, got him to change his mind. So
what you're, I'm not sure I quite follow you. What you're saying then, that you really don't want a new trial. You just want us to reverse the conviction because the trial court didn't grant a continuance during trial.
No, what I'm telling you is I made a record with Casey, or just in our file, that the potential exists for him to be charged with new counts of criminal pedophilia if there's a new trial. So that's why we didn't pursue the new trial before, as you set out, is because he decided to just accept the verdict, accept the sentence.
I see.
But at some point after the deadline, which is 10 days after the judgment, I believe I filed the notice 14 or 15 days after the judgment, his family had convinced him to go ahead with the appeal. And then, so that's why that wasn't done, because we'd had an understanding, an agreement that there would be no appeal between myself and Mr. Alker.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.